Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. One aspect of the American dream is that each succeeding generation would do better than the previous. That held true for much of the 20th century, but today things have changed. Today, despite doing many of the right things to get ahead, younger generations have hit a wall. Many are saddled with debt, can't buy a home or save for retirement, and as the cost of living continues to rise, their confidence about ever achieving the American dream is fading. A new survey conducted by U.S. Bank found that while many Americans continue to make responsible financial choices like budgeting, reducing leisure spending, even creating financial plans, those things don't seem to be making a difference. Many are overwhelmed by what they are experiencing, but there is a silver lining, if you look more deeply into that survey. It shows that professional advice with financial planning can significantly improve confidence and feelings of control. But is that a mirage? This hour, we are going to take a closer look at the headwinds faced by people in today's economy, at that survey, and more. Dr. John Connaughton is back with us. He's an economist at the Bell College of Business at UNC Charlotte and director of the UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast. He's here along with Eric Friedman, chief investment officer for U.S. Bank Asset Management Group in the Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill area. And Heather Patrick is with us. She's a wealth planner at U.S. Bank's Private Wealth Management here in Charlotte. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Good morning.
So, John, I'm starting with you. When we first began hearing stories around the country about younger people living in their childhood bedrooms or their parents' basements, not getting married, not starting families, many chalked it up to some sort of a generational attitude change where the previous generations were more willing to work harder and get ahead. That is not what is going on. There are forces at work impeding the progress of even the hardest workers in America. Aside from inflation, what has changed in the U.S. American economy to make that happen?
Well, I think there are a couple of things, Mike, but I don't think you should underestimate the impact inflation has had over the last 5 years in making life difficult. Prices are 25% higher than they were in January of 2021. And that's a significant increase, and that really does impact people, particularly people trying to start out. Second thing, because you have to, when you're starting out, you have to build a household. You got to buy a vacuum cleaner. You got to buy, you know, everything. But the second thing is that it hasn't been equal. That 25% increase in prices hasn't been equal across all product lines. I just did a little calculation. Suppose you want to go out and buy a house and have a $400,000 mortgage. All right. Not that unusual in the Charlotte area. 6.75% interest rate will get you a $2,600 a month principal and interest payment. You knock that down to 3.5%, which is what we saw essentially almost a decade ago. And, you know, that's $1,800. That's $800 difference. That's a one-third reduction, basically, in the price of a mortgage payment a month. That is significant. So, yeah, there have been some, there certainly is some evidence that younger generation may not be working as hard, may work differently. But the bottom line is prices have really impacted people's perception of how their life is going to play out for them over the next 5-10 years.
And prices went up noticeably during the pandemic or after the pandemic because of supply chain disruptions. But that was years ago.
No, there are three causes of inflation, Mike.
Okay.
The one you mentioned is basically cost push, which is a supply chain problem. That was a problem during COVID mostly. So that was a problem in 2020. But in 2021, the problem became essentially too much money chasing too few goods, the spending. Since January of 21, the U.S. debt, if you will, has gone up by almost $11 trillion, almost a 30% increase in the size of the U.S. debt. We're spending like drunken sailors under both Democrat and Republican administration. This is apolitical. We are running a deficit that we can't afford going forward. at the end of the day, we're not going to be able to afford this 5, 10 years from now.
So inflation played a major role in the last election. It could be argued, I suppose, that it played a role in last week's election around various aspects of areas of the country. And Donald Trump ran promising to lower inflation. The reverse has happened. Many because in some part due to his policies with regard to tariffs and uncertainty revolving around those tariffs. But is this something that any politician, any political figure can control? Can a politician bring down inflation substantially, John?
Probably not. And the reason for that is that we have become addicted to a couple of things. One is large benefit entitlements that are essentially the third rail of politics. You can't go after a lot of the non-discretionary spending that's been built into the system over the last 50 years. And that's just, you know, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, or, you know, SNAP benefits. All of these things are locked in, and there's not much anybody can do about them. And they're automatic spending, I guess, except every once in a while the government shuts down and people don't get their checks. But those are things we can't do anything about. The problem is, Mike, that what's going on here, and this is the issue with housing and why mortgage rates are so high. Not even the Fed can deal with mortgage rates. That's a technical reason why they can't, but they can't really deal with it. The federal funds rate, which is what they have control over or influence over, is totally disconnected from long-term bond rates and mortgage rates. Those are market determined, and it's inflationary expectations. And I don't think anybody that's willing to lend money in the mortgage market has any expectation that inflation is going to be tackled long-term. And so you're constantly going to be building in a 3.5% inflationary premium into your long-term rates, which wasn't there 10 years ago. So I think that's one of the things. And I just don't think, Mike, that the politicians, I don't care whether you're Democrats, Republicans, it doesn't really matter. We've come accustomed to buying votes with, we'll give you this free stuff. It's like an Oprah Winfrey program, you know. You get a free car, you get a free car, you get a free car. I mean, that's really what we're dealing with here. And that's become the norm. If we looked at the last election, Mike, presidential election 10 months ago, or I guess it was almost a year ago now, right? Both sides were giving what? No tax on Social Security, no tax on tips, no tax. You can't run a government like that. You can't provide the social safety net that we've become accustomed to by not taxing.
We've become accustomed to this idea of the American dream. Most of us were raised to believe that if you worked hard, if you applied yourself, if you got an education, if you made good monetary decisions, you would get ahead and most likely live a better life than your parents lived in terms of economics and in terms of material goods. That idea is evaporating, or may have evaporated for a lot of people. What are the aside from political turmoil, what are the dangers of that, John?
Well, I think we're seeing it in terms of the country's turn. Increasingly, younger people are turning toward a more socialistic approach to our economy in terms of how we allocate resources.
Is that a danger?
I think there's two sides to that story. All right, I'll give you kind of a narrative, an example, if you will. So in 1990, okay, what now constitutes the 27 country European Union and the United States economy were roughly the same size. Okay, now I realize that's 35 years ago, but they're roughly the same size in terms of GDP. Today, the US economy is about one third bigger than the euro. And the example, of course, is they completely missed out on all the economic development that took place associated with the technological revolution in the late 90s with the internet and, you know, all the stuff that's been going on, the social media, et cetera. They don't have any of that, and they've not developed any of it, okay? Their economies are not innovative, and they're not innovative because they're so heavily regulated. And that's the downside risk of becoming less capitalistic and more socialistic. Now, does that mean the people live less well off? That's a question that's much more complicated to answer. I mean, is there solace with the fact that you are covered cradle to grave? And is that worth the trade-off of having a much lower standard of living? So that's really what we're talking about here.
Eric Friedman is with us. He's the Chief Investment Officer for U.S. Bank Asset Management Group. And U.S. Bank, Eric, surveyed 5,000 adults, and they discovered that, quote, although many Americans continue to make responsible financial choices like budgeting, reducing leisure spending, and creating financial plans, a majority feel a lack of control over many important life decisions. They feel overwhelmed. And the head of the wealth management team at U.S. Bank calls this a seismic shift in the American dream. Was this a surprise or merely empirical evidence of what we already knew?
Mike, good morning. Thanks so much for having us on. I think it is more of a reveal of what's already underlying the psyche of Americans. And I think kind of reflecting on your earlier comments, one of the considerations we have to really focus in on is this idea of control. And the human being is wired psychologically to crave control, whether it's what we're going to eat, where we're going to sleep, very basic components of everyday life. And when you factor in things like a very dynamic job market, which we have right now, there I think is a consistent feeling from respondents to our survey that they do feel some level of control with respect to their effort, with respect to your point earlier, their education, that if they do, quote unquote, the right things, that there will be benefits that will accrue to them over time. But where we see that lack of control, where we see the concerns about a lack of control, is the broader system around them with respect to politics and also with respect to financial markets, which have become more linked over time. And I think that, you know, John and I both spent a lot of time looking at data and analyzing trends and forecasting. We're investors. We allocate a lot of money across a lot of different markets. And so we have to have a good handle on things that we think we can predict or at least reasonably predict. Things like what's happening in Washington, D.C., or foreign trade policy, or how Beijing is feeling about rare earth metals, these are not controllables by the average American. And I think that what you're seeing revealed in the data is this idea that people really want to feel like they have more control, but they've become a bit more distrustful, if you will. And again, I think to the point, this is a bipartisan issue. I think this is true under any standing president, that there's a level, if you will, of agency, or I should say a lack thereof, that people feel with respect to what do they do if they put in their effort and they work really hard, and then what? That's the part, Mike, where people are seeing a real disparity, if you will, in agency.
I only have about 90 seconds, but your survey found that this undermining of confidence is not just psychological. It is making people who are trying the hardest to get ahead wonder if their efforts are worth the sacrifice. So in that scenario, is it easy to imagine that the people who are making those sacrifices will say, well, it's not worth it, so I'm going to stop, which will exacerbate the situation? Do you see evidence of that happening?
That is a big risk, Mike. I think that, you know, the image, and I know that we're up on a break, is that think of a person on a dock looking to hop onto a boat that keeps drifting further away from them. That's the feeling that we're seeing very consistently, especially across lower income and middle income age cohorts or income cohorts. Those are individuals who are really feeling that boat drifting further and further away from where they wish they could hop on.
Heather Patrick is also with us. She's a wealth planner for U.S. Bank. She's been sitting here patiently waiting to be asked a question, and I'm going to do that when we come back from the break. We have to take that break now. We're here with John Connaughton, an economist at the Belk College of Business at UNC Charlotte, Eric Friedman with U.S. Bank, and Heather Patrick as well. And we'll talk about this fading American dream, where it's going, and there's a silver lining to this survey, as I said. How having a financial planner can actually help you. We'll talk about that and more when we come back.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the fading American dream, what it may result from that, what can be done to reverse it. Dr. John Connaughton, an economist with the UNC Charlotte, the Belk College of Business with us. Eric Friedman, Chief Investment Officer of U.S. Bank Asset Management Group, and Heather Patrick, Wealth Planner with U.S. Bank. They have done a survey on all of this of 5,000 Americans to see what impact this is having and how it's working, and there's the silver lining, which we'll get to. Heather, the financial website Investopedia had individuals rank which parts of the American dream that were most important to them. Being able to retire comfortably came out on top, followed by the ability to afford health care, then owning a home, followed by starting a family, owning a new car, going on a yearly vacation. That's at the bottom or toward the bottom. 85% put being able to retire comfortably first. Having a wedding came out dead last at 55%. Those are their priorities. As a financial planner who talks to people every day about their desires, does that match what you're seeing in your clients?
You know, Mike, I think it really does. What we're seeing is a lot of compromise, right? So it's not necessarily clients that are completely backing away from what their goals are, what their retirement goals are, but it's really just compromising on some of those timelines. So for instance, last week I was in a client meeting where they were going to buy their retirement house sooner rather than later. And so then when they get to retirement age, they'd have that there, they'd be able to sell their primary residence. Things like that are still in the plan. They're just a little bit further out. So it's not a complete stop to some of those plans, but we are definitely seeing some compromise there. And really just, you know, breaking down some of those actionable items, like Eric was referring to, controlling those controllables, and allowing them to really just sit down and focus on building that foundation to a financial plan so they feel a little bit more in control. Obviously, you know, the world politics are something that are completely out of our hands, at least for the four of us here. And so making sure that these items that you do have control of, you're sitting down, you're reviewing them often, you're really digging in, you're being honest with yourself. Those are things that, you know, we talk to on a regular basis.
Eric.
You know, I think Heather nailed it, Mike, in terms of what we're seeing across both our client experiences plus the data. And I think just to amplify, we're not seeing either through our data or through our client base, which is vast and across the entire country, what we're going to call very abnormal asks or like conspicuous consumption, things that people are looking to do that are exorbitant relative to their budget. I think there's a narrative out there that people don't want to own homes, that, you know, whether it's whatever millennials or even those that are younger than millennials don't want to own homes. Actually, that's not true. They still want the things that their parents have wanted. They want kids. They want to own a house. They want to retire, to your point. But back to that image of the boat drifting further from the dock, it just feels a lot less attainable to a larger portion of people. And I think that what John mentioned earlier about inflation, we're certainly seeing in our data as well. Inflation is a very disproportionate tax. If you think about what is in the consumption basket of a lower income consumer, it's mostly shelter, food, and transportation costs, all of which have gone up significantly. So if we're saying to a young person these days, we want you to not feel great about the system you're in, if you will, and here's a home price that's very unaffordable, probably a mortgage rate that even though back in the 80s is tiny compared to what it used to be, there's a real feeling of unsettling. That being said, what people are trying to do with their money from our perspective is not exorbitant. It's not rooted in, let's call it overly lofty goals. In some cases, it's just, you know, the right to carry on a good and decent life.
Even those who can't, who don't have or can't afford or don't have sufficient assets yet to afford a financial planner, Heather. We've all seen the commercials on television and that financial planner's job is to help you achieve your goals, whatever they are. We just went out the went through this list of goals that people have, and that is retiring comfortably, then healthcare, being able to afford that, starting a family, owning a home, a new car, going on a vacation. Are those priorities in the right order?
Yeah, I think, it really just depends on the individual at the end of the day. We always, still recommend that foundational, you can't really start a financial plan, whether that's with an advisor, a team, or just on your own. You can't really start a financial plan unless you have that budget figured out. So it's really sitting down, taking the time to figure out what is coming in and going out. If you don't have that, it is incredibly hard to figure out what those goals are and what they should be and what order they should be in. At the same time, you could figure out a budget, and later down the road, you have a new goal that comes along. Maybe it's, putting that down payment on the first house. If that new goal will then throw your entire budget out of whack, you're ruining that foundation. So you have to do one step at a time from the bottom up. And it's sometimes it's a really hard pill to swallow, right? When we think of, our picture of success is retirement. Just that in general is like, okay, where do I start? What do I do? So breaking it down into these smaller steps, starting with the foundation of the budget, paying down debts, and then, eventually saving, whether it's the nest egg and the emergency fund, and eventually retirement. But really just knowing that you are able to break it down. And another thing on the psychological side is, from a survey like this, you're not alone, right? We saw that, there's so many Americans that haven't really sat down and started that foundation of their financial plan. And that's okay. But the earlier you can do it, the better. So today's the best day to start.
So, John, one aspect of the fallout from all this inflation, et cetera, has been that people, particularly young people, are losing faith in our institutions and the ability of anybody in power to do anything to help them. And according to an NPR survey, only 16% of young people believe that democracy is working for them. Are they confusing with democracy with capitalism?
I don't think so. Before I answer your question, let me throw something out that Eric and Heather brought up. There's a dichotomy in the economy between how people feel about things and to some extent what's really happening. So when we look at the, we've been trained, Eric, I know you've been trained in this, Heather, I know you have as well, that the things we look at are GDP growth and unemployment, because that really does dictate how well the economy is working for us. We look at unemployment right now, it's at 4.3%. Again, we haven't gotten a number for a couple of months, but there are private information sources that suggest that it's 4.2, 4.3, which is certainly a very acceptable and certainly isn't a pressure on individuals. The Atlanta Fed GDP Now tracker is suggesting the economy is growing at about a 4% clip in real terms. Those are real good numbers. And then you switch over to how people feel, and you look at the Michigan Consumer Confidence Sentiment Index, and that's, not an all-time lows, but it's not a whole lot different from what it was back in during COVID, and almost as low as it was back during the Great Recession back in 2008-9. So you've got this incredible dichotomy about how people feel versus what's really happening in the economy. And the second thing, Mike, that's also problematic is we know this for a fact, that a lot of what's driving the economy right now is higher income individuals spending, like the US government is, like I guess we call them drunken sailors, that are propping up the economy. Whereas Eric was mentioning, these lower income folks are really stressed because so much of what they purchase is necessities versus wants. And those things have been hit harder by inflation. So now, as far as democracy versus capitalism, yeah, I think most people don't really appreciate the difference between. They just know that the system that's a capitalist democracy isn't necessarily working for them right now.
A lot of today's leaders are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, and they've come up at a different time when achieving the American dream was still a possibility, and they did. They have made it. A lot of younger people believe, and probably accurately, that they are out of touch, that they don't understand what these younger people who are just starting out in life are facing today. And so politics is failing them. And then you have the government shutdown, which allegedly just ended last night, where politics prevented the social safety net from working for a lot of people. When you combine that with a system that seems to consistently reward the wealthy with bigger and bigger perks while keeping working wages low, are these people correct, these young people? Are policymakers out of touch? Are our policies doing harm? John.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good question, Mike. And, you know, you commented about the older politicians, 60s and 70s. One of the problems we have right now is younger folks don't actually have any historical knowledge of what went on. Give you a little story. 1979, okay, I was building my first house. And I qualified for a mortgage on that house at 10%, okay? 10% mortgage rate. In the process of building the house, mortgage rates climbed to 17.5%. You remember this, Mike. Nobody else does, but you and I both remember this. And John didn't qualify for that mortgage anymore, and I didn't get that house, okay? So, you know, housing affordability. And if you look around Charlotte, and you look at a lot of houses that were built in the early 80s, up until about 83 or 84, that's where you find a lot of starter homes that were 1,100, 1,200 square feet because people could not afford at the time what would be a normal home would be 1,800, 1,900 square feet. Houses shrank considerably because of affordability issues. So this is something that ebbs and flows over time. So I would suggest to you that, yes, compared to the last 10, 20, even 30 years, housing has become a lot more difficult to afford compared to 50 years ago. It's still a pretty good bargain. So it's all relative, and there's a lot of lack of understanding what happened. And that's not a, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, you wouldn't expect people in their 30s to remember what happened 50 years ago. I mean, it just, you know, it's just not part of the deal. But it affordability, particularly of housing market, ebbs and flows over time, and we've certainly seen worse situations in the past for housing affordability.
Eric.
I think that's a great reflection by John. And just to put a stat behind it, Mike, which is recent and I think very indicative, the average age of a first-time homebuyer in this country right now is 40 years old. And if we pan back to even 15 wow. years ago, that number was in the 20s. And so if you think about what a house has meant for an individual or a family, obviously its primary purpose is to be a dwelling, back to those very primal urges and necessities that we all have. But it also has been the largest asset and liability on people's personal balance sheets. And if you take that away, recognizing that mortgage costs over any point of time, when you're first buying a house, unless you're very lucky, your mortgage expense is going to be a large portion of your income. But over time, it lessens. And while and hopefully that asset is appreciating. And so you have a something on your balance sheet that you have some flexibility with over time. And Heather mentioned that with her example earlier. But when you have people pushing into their late 30s and early 40s and have not touched a house yet, and a lot of life has already happened, whether it's family development, whether that's relationships, whether that's different jobs, geographic decisioning, if you will. So I think that the home price affordability is a real issue that certainly needs to be addressed. Last thing I'll say is this, the other variable is that what politicians are facing now and what we as a society are facing now is this increasing risk of longevity, which is a wonderful thing. We're all living longer, which is a great thing. Concurrently, are we preparing both as an economy through social safety nets, but also as individuals through reskilling, retooling, such that we can adapt to artificial intelligence? We can adapt to other challenges that will come up for the next 10, 20, 30 years during what will be a very, very long life. So we don't necessarily have a house to fall back on as much as we had. And those are the issues that we think are really important. That's why, again, our survey suggests people have less faith in the system because the system doesn't seem to be working for them the way that perhaps it did in prior years.
Heather, he just mentioned the cost of a mortgage, the monthly payment on a mortgage. A lot of people can't afford that, but I have found that my mortgage payment is lower than a lot of what people are paying for apartment rent in Charlotte. So the key here is to build enough wealth to be able to afford the down payment to get into a house at a reasonably low interest rate. And we're going to look at this U.S. Bank survey in a moment and some of its findings that paint a rosier picture than we're talking about here. But as someone who deals with clients on a daily basis as a wealth planner, how do you start to build wealth? Because you have to save before you can come to you and say, put my pot of money here to work. You got to have some money to work with. So where do you start if you got to make mortgage payments or rent payments and car payments and put food on the table?
Yes, and it's a very overwhelming thing to think about. But like I said, it's getting that foundation. So sitting down, writing out your budget, it's not going to take 30 minutes. It's going to take multiple times of sitting there being honest with yourself. We all can be a little bit guilty sometimes of, grabbing that $7 coffee on the way to work, or, subscribing to a streaming service that we completely forget is there and we never use. So it's those things. It's really being honest with yourself, making sure that you know what's coming in the door and exactly what's going out the door. Once you do that, then you can really focus and prioritize in terms of paying down debts. So obviously, short-term debts seem to have the highest interest rates. So those are going to be very important to pay off. If you don't, then those are the ones that are going to add up very quickly, and you'll very you'll get over your head very quickly. So it's the priority of paying down those short-term debts and then building that safety net. So safety net is different to everyone. Sometimes it's 3 months of spending, which you need your budget, right, to figure out what 3 months of spending actually looks like. Sometimes it's 6 months. Whatever is going to help you sleep better at night is a very personal thing. If you have dependents, sometimes we err on the longer side of that safety net. And then finally, making sure that you know what's available to you from your employer. So if you do have a 401k match, then it's looking at, how can I possibly save at least that amount to take advantage of the match? Otherwise, you're leaving money on the table. So it's really just breaking it down. Like I said, being honest with yourself and ensuring that, you can take it one step at a time. Not everyone wants to sit there and say, okay, what does retirement look like right now? Because maybe retirement is 40 years away, and that's all right. But be honest with what is happening right now, so that eventually down the road, and as you review this annually, that's another important thing, reviewing it annually, to make sure you're on track.
But I want to talk about how you get started, because there are a lot of people out there who can't imagine talking to you or building wealth because they're worried about putting the next set of groceries on their credit card at 25%. We'll talk about that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting author Robin Wall Kimmerer, known for braiding sweetgrass and the service berry, sharing perspectives on Indigenous knowledge and ecology on December 2nd at the Gambrill Center. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the fading American dream, how to stump it, how to get around it, how to make it not fade anymore for you with Dr. John Connaughton, economist at the Bell College of Business at UNC Charlotte. Eric Friedman's the chief investment officer at U.S. Bank Asset Management Group. And Heather Patrick is wealth planner for U.S. Bank. And you were talking, Heather, just before the break, about how we begin to build wealth. And there are a lot of people who can't imagine it because they can't afford to do it. They have nothing in savings. They're living paycheck to paycheck, and with rising prices, they're finding it difficult to put food on the table, and many times they're putting it on their credit card and maybe not paying it off at the end of the month. So they're accruing vast amounts of interest very quickly. But you also mentioned on the way to work, forgoing that cup of coffee, that $5, $6, $7 cup of coffee. Is it really that simple? Not having that cup of coffee, not having the most expensive smartphone, finding a cheap cell phone plan that's less expensive than perhaps some of the major carriers. Is it really that easy to start saving, pinching pennies to save big money over time?
I think easy is not quite the right word, but you know, it is a lot of discipline, right? You know, sometimes I'm very guilty of it on the way to work. That cup of coffee is needed to get me through the day. So it's really just making sure that, you know, as you, you know, do those treat yourself type of things, it's not a regularly occurring expense. So just making sure that you really, you know, you can't tie yourself up so much that you are miserable. At the same time, when you do, you know, reward yourself for things, make sure there's a reason behind it. And even when you make that budget, when you review it often and you can see progress, that really provides a lot of confidence and some motivation to continue and keep down that path of building those savings. So maybe it's not spending the $7 on the coffee, but putting that $7 for that same month into an account. Because compound interest, right? So that's really how you're going to build the wealth over time. Instead of waiting until you're able to put a bigger amount into, you know, a retirement account or some sort of investment account, it's really just doing it now, even if it's a few dollars a month. I know that even getting to that can be very difficult for some people. But if you start the goal there and then make small increases every year, it makes it a little bit more easy.
So we have a comment, an email comment from a 33-year-old who writes us, "I appreciate the guest's comments, but does that expensive cup of coffee really make a difference in the long run relative to how much a home or retirement is going to cost? Is it a difference that makes a difference? Will saving that weekly cost touch those things?" John, you applauded both times Heather mentioned foregoing a cup of coffee on the way to work. I would imagine you have a yes answer to his question.
And I actually texted to the group the idea of, do electronic payments hinder the ability to be frugal or to save? It's one thing to take that $5 out and give the person $5 for that cup of coffee versus, okay, just flashing your phone in front of a little piece of plastic. You know, there's no sense of something's leaving you when you use your phone for a payment system. And Heather mentioned not only the $5 or $7 cup of coffee, whatever, she also mentioned the idea of the streaming services and other types of services that you that are, you know, hooked to your credit card and you don't even know when they're going. They just get pulled out. And, you know, I was looking today at one that I was thinking of getting, and they give you a great deal the first year, okay, $49.95 for the first year, and then it renews automatically at $129 the next year, okay? And you'll forget a year from now. I'll guarantee you everybody that's listening to this program will forget a year from now that it's going to renew automatically. Once it renews, you're stuck for another year. There's no prorate or refund or anything like that. You're done. And so I think that electronic payments have really changed the ability of people to become savers.
So would it be a good idea for people who are really trying to make a dent in all of this to go back to using cash?
I don't know, but I want to one more thing. So you buy a $5, $6, $7 cup of coffee at Starbucks every day, 200 days a year, versus brewing a really good cup of Pete's coffee at home. And you're going to save $1,000, and that's after tax money. Yeah. And you do that on a couple of other things that you do like this. And pretty soon, you're a client of Heather's.
Exactly. I was just going to say that pretty soon you have enough money to go see a financial planner. The same writer of this email, 33 years old, says, "I also have a hard time believing that in the 70s and 80s, people had to work as long to earn that down payment on a home, despite mortgage rates. The point doesn't seem rates, but buying power. How long did you have to work to save that down payment? I don't remember this, John. I know it was tough the first time I bought a house. I thought, how am I ever going to afford this? How am I ever going to make this payment? I owe the bank a lot of money over 30 years. How am I going to do this? Was it harder? Easier?
I'm not sure because I didn't experience it. I'm a veteran, and so I got a VA loan, zero down. You know, all I had to do was figure out how to make the payment. So I was fortunate in that regard. So I personally don't know whether it's harder then or harder now. I suspect it's harder now. But again, I just want to go back to saving some money. You know, $1,000 here and $1,000 here, to, you know, quote a former Senator Everett Dixon, pretty soon you're talking real money. And, you know, but it starts at $1 a time or $5 a time or something like that. Yeah. And I don't have an answer for your question about whether we should go back to cash, but it is, you feel it when you put $5 down on the counter.
I mean, I remember having to go to the ATM before credit cards became that ubiquitous, or phones. You could just put your phone down, and when you had to go to the ATM and you were taking cash out of your wallet to buy stuff, you did have this sense: this is mine, and it's going away from me right now.
I think a bigger problem is automatic payments.
I know you want to talk about that. I know, Eric, that you want to talk about this, but in order to invest, you have to have money, and having money starts with savings, and that starts with putting together a budget. When you're building that budget to save, where do you start? Because a lot of people are literally working paycheck to paycheck. Is it simply finding the waste, the things that you really don't need, and putting that money someplace else and not touching it? Is that it? Is it as easy as that?
Yeah, Mike, I'm going to defer to Heather. She's our expert on that topic. Just to answer the question really quickly from the email that came in, I think it's a very thoughtful point that individual raised about home price affordability. I agree. The rate isn't the real issue. I mean, it certainly is a contributing factor, but without question, the biggest variable is just the absolute price. And in the 60s, 70s, 80s, you had significant build out of this country in all sorts of communities, ingenuity in community building and types of homes. And so now, when there is less build out, if you will, we have more established cities and localities, it becomes an issue of supply and demand. So I think that like, it's a very prescient point that the individual made, but I defer to Heather for her perspective on how to start. She runs laps on me on those topics, Mike.
And the other thing that we haven't really talked about is the fact that home prices are higher than they were in the 70s and 80s, substantially higher than they were. And a lot of older people have low-rate mortgages, and they probably would like to downsize, but they choose not to downsize because the mortgage rates are higher. So why pay more for less? So they're staying put, and people can't afford to move up. Heather, same question. Is it really as easy as just identifying things that you absolutely can do without, or you can save money by doing it in a different way and taking the difference and socking it away someplace? Is it as easy as that?
Yes and no. I think it's one part of the pie, right? So it's finding out where that waste is, where things that you really don't need or don't realize, you know, that you even have. But sometimes, you know, a budget is as skinny as it can get. So then you're going to look at other resources, right? So it's knowing that, one, you're not alone, reaching out to, whether that's finding maybe the grocery store that isn't the closest one to your house, but is an extra mile away and has cheaper prices, things like that. So it's a little bit of thinking outside the box of how I can make that budget a little bit skinnier. Maybe it's not that you're, you know, necessarily wasting anything, but maybe just not taking full advantage of some resources that are available to you. I'll go back really quick to that automatic, you know, the payments conversation of just remember there's the flip side of that, right? So when you are saving, things that are automatic that you can set up for recurring savings or recurring, you know, if you get a bonus at the end of the year or a raise at the end of the year, setting up so that your savings are automatically increasing as well. Make sure that, you know, you're not just taking advantage of the convenience side, which may make it a little bit too easy to spend, but that you're also taking advantage of the saving side of automatic payments and automatic transfers.
If you're one of those people who's desperately trying to make ends meet and you do have dreams for your family and for your own personal life, and you would like to retire at a reasonable age in a comfortable lifestyle, and you're working toward that, and then along comes another survey, this Investopedia website survey that says that the average cost, lifetime cost of the American dream is just north of $5 million, and that is well above what most people will earn in their lifetime, do people just throw up their hands and say, well, then forget it? Go ahead, John.
I don't know the answer to that question. I wish it did, but it is a daunting task for sure. But my guess is, yeah, maybe you don't make five, maybe you make four, maybe you make three. But, you know, as Heather was mentioning, there are lots of ways to improve the quality of your life. I was just thinking about this when Heather was talking about, you know, maybe you go to a food store that's a few miles further away that's got better prices. I mean, how many people that are struggling, I see this all the time, how many people, young people that are struggling simply won't walk into an Aldi's or Lido, but they want to shop at whole paycheck, as we call it in our household. Wouldn't go through the threshold of a food line. Okay.
Right.
So when people make choices, and I get it, because they work 40 hours or 50 hours a week, they work hard, and they don't want to be denied the utility that they can get from that money that they've earned by putting it away in hopes that 30 years from now or 40 years from now, it'll grow to a big enough nest that they can retire a little bit before they're 67 or 68 years old.
I could give you more.
I get the trade-offs that they're making.
I could give you more information from this Investopedia thing that tells you how much money you have to earn to achieve anything in this life. But I don't want to do that because that'll just depress people. Let's talk about something brighter that this U.S. Bank survey found. You took this survey in June. You talked to 5,000 adults, 18 and older, and the margin of error on this survey is 1.5% plus or minus with a 95% confidence level. So it's pretty accurate. And it found that financial planning and professional advice significantly improves confidence and feelings of control. Okay, but you have to have a planner to get there. So, Heather, how much money, what's the minimum amount of money you need before you can talk to a financial planner or before they can help you?
No, I would say it really changes across the industry. So depending on the institution, depending on the group, the broker, there's a lot more work behind that decision that I think needs to go into it, figuring out what type of team or individual is right for you, making sure you interview them and know that it's a comfortable fit, because financials are a very intimate thing to talk about. So you want to be confident that who you are talking with is someone who's going to take kind of the whole picture into consideration and be very holistic. In terms of what the dollar amount is, it changes. It's kind of all over the industry is a little bit different.
There's a difference between a financial planner and a broker, just as there is a difference between a broker and going online and doing this on one of those websites where you can throw money at stocks. So do those sites work as well for beginning investors? Eric, do you need a person? When you find a person, should they be fee-based? Should they be commission-based? How do you trust this person?
Yeah, Mike, without making this sound self-serving, which I won't for our firm, I kind of view planning as like going to a gym. You can go to a gym and lift weights on your own, and you'll have some level of success. You can go online to our website, lots of other websites, and go to Retirement Calculator and plug in numbers. As you add on services like personal training and a specific diet and increase in the quality of the weights or the exercise equipment, obviously that costs more. So we think people can start and go to our website and go to other competitors' websites and start with a very baseline retirement calculator. Usually the threshold is somewhere between, let's call it, $50,000 or $100,000 to get more add-ons, if you will. But even just starting with to Heather's point from earlier, a very honest assessment of what you have. Most people don't take that step. And we think being incremental over time is the right way to approach it.
And your survey says that among those with less than $50,000 in net worth, simply having a financial plan nearly doubles confidence in your readiness for retirement. It also shows that 89% of those with the financial advisor feel in control of saving for retirement. 85% are confident that they'll be able to own a home versus 60% who do not have a financial advisor. I only have 30 seconds, Heather. When you build a budget, when you have to allow for shelter and clothing and food and transportation. Is everything else gravy? Is everything else a target for elimination so that you can save?
I would say everything needs to be looked at holistically. Definitely.
I wish we had more time. We don't. Any final words from anybody? Any predictions for the coming year, John?
I was just going to say, I'm a PhD economist. I've had a financial planner since I've been 30. So they've changed, but they know what they're doing.
Okay. John Connaughton, economist at the Belk College of Business, UNC Charlotte, and the director of the UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast. Eric Friedman, chief investment officer with U.S. Bank Asset Management Group, and Heather Patrick, wealth planner with U.S. Bank. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.